Black Information Network and six-time Emmy-nominated news anchor Vanessa Tyler welcome you to Blackland,
a podcast about the ground on which the Black community stands right now.
From stories about salvation
and loss.
I loved a person who had an HIV diagnosis.
To dreams achieved
or yet unfulfilled.
From people who have made it.
I sat down with a therapist and I began my journey.
To those left behind.
Listen to Blackland on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts,
or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Nazi V2 was a rocket-powered bomb traveling faster than the speed of sound. You couldn't hear it coming. A technological miracle, but a military and economic disaster for Nazi Germany. How did the V2 come into existence, and why were so many of the people it hurt not the people you might expect? Join me, Tim Harford, host of Cautionary Tales, for my gripping mini-series on the V2 rocket, available now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, fellow 20-somethings. It's your girl, Sydney Winter. And guess what? The wait is finally over. Season 4 of Crying in Public is here, and I'm flying solo for the very first time. That's right, no co-host to rein me in, just me, myself, and the mic. From relationships to careers and all the awkward encounters in between, we're covering it all. So mark your calendars and set your reminders, because Crying in Public is dropping its juiciest season yet. Listen to the new season of Crying in Public on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On October 17th, 2007, Chris Smith was on parole for a previous robbery conviction when an armed robbery happened at a Cincinnati Bell wireless store in his area. A disguised assailant brandishing a gun commanded the customers to hit the floor and demanded all the money from the register before fleeing in a blue Ford Expedition. The owner of that car, Chris Smith's girlfriend. Soon after the robbery, the Blue Expedition was all over the news, and Chris texted his girlfriend to report the vehicle stolen. As police were preparing to arrest him, Chris fled to the apartment of an old friend, Charles Allen, where he removed his ankle monitor. It wasn't long before Chris was arrested, prosecuted, and convicted by circumstantial evidence that was so powerful it overwhelmed physical evidence to the contrary. After all, he'd done things like this before. But this is wrongful conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. Today's episode features some circumstantial evidence that definitely twists somebody's head around if you're sitting on a jury. So fasten your seatbelt. This is a crazy story. I'm really honored to have the people here to tell it, including the man himself who lived this nightmare, Chris Smith. So Chris, it's about time we did this, and I'm glad you're here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
And with him is his attorney, Michelle Berry Godsey, who actually began her career, as I understand it, at the Ohio Innocence Project with this case. So, Michelle, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And, of course, it'll surprise exactly no one that we have another case out of Ohio because, man, Ohio, it's, you know.
It's a hotbed.
Yeah, with all due respect to anybody who lives there. But in terms of justice, it ain't great. An avid listener knows that because we have really a high proportion of cases out of Ohio. But before we get into that part of the story, Chris, what was your life like? I understand you were a musician, had a couple of kids growing up in Cincinnati. Is all that accurate?
Yes, sir. 7-year-old son, and just had a daughter with 7 months when all this happened.
What kind of music? What'd you play? What was your thing?
So I was a hip hop artist and a writer as well. I was discovered by a manager who signed boy band Youngstown, discovered Neo, and gave me an opportunity, took me out to L.A., and they had me as the next big thing. And so I was writing with Neo, Mike City, Chingy, working with Polly Paul, Grammy-nominated producers and things like that, so I was on my way.
Before making this progress in the music industry, Chris had a prior robbery conviction. But by 2007, he had served his time and was living cleanly on parole. Then, on October 17th, 2007, at around 3:40 p.m., a man wearing a wig, sunglasses, and his t-shirt collar pulled up over his mouth ran into a Cincinnati Bell wireless store with a gun, ordered the customers to the ground, told the manager to empty the cash register, and fled with about $800 in a blue Ford Expedition. So, with his prior conviction, in addition to some other circumstantial evidence, Chris became a prime suspect.
the police in the area admitted that they immediately suspected Chris and his brother, Ricky. Now, Ricky was lucky because he was actually in the county jail at the time on some petty drug possession thing. So he immediately was eliminated, but they still latched on to Chris simply because he was on parole at the time and they knew that he lived in this area. So that's one thing. The second thing is it was known fairly early on that the getaway truck that was used, the blue Ford Expedition, it was traced to his girlfriend at the time, who told the police that she had basically given the truck to Chris for his personal use. So those two things don't look good on Chris. But the bigger picture that was really unfolding here, like you mentioned, this was the robbery of a Cincinnati Bell wireless store. There was one eyewitness to this crime, and he was across the street driving, and he saw the man run out of the store carrying a laptop. He believed it was a laptop. That's what he told on the 911 call, and described the gunman as a light-skinned black man. And even knowing how this caller had described the gunman, police came to the scene with lineups already matching Chris's description.
Chris, have you ever been a light-skinned man?
No, I've been pretty dark all my life.
I'm glad you pointed that out. So the robber hopped in this getaway car, a blue Ford Expedition. The 911 caller tried to follow him, but lost the truck. And soon police were on the scene and they found the truck along with the robber's costume. So this was 2007. Everyone knew at that point to do DNA testing. That testing did occur before trial, but happened a little bit further down the line.
Before the DNA testing, during the immediate aftermath, Chris was the focus of the investigation, something that became clear to him when he recognized the truck that he shared with his girlfriend on the 5 o'clock news.
On a breaking news story, you looking and you're like, hold on, wait a minute, like, what do I do? And so when you're from the city, hood, whatever you want to call it, it's just like, you don't call the police because you grow up not to trust the police, right? So I'm reaching out to the person who name the truck is in, and I'm like, listen, I didn't do this, so report this stolen.
And so we ended up getting Chris's text messages at the exact moment that this news story aired. So we had that in our favor to show, but no one ended up caring.
With the circumstantial evidence available, it wasn't long before police began surrounding Chris's apartment.
And so you see all these plainclothes officers around the property. Then you have my daughter mom in there who was with me years prior when I went to jail the same way, right? So she's remembering this. So it's a lot of trauma and stuff going on. And she's, oh my God, you have to go. And I'm like, go. I didn't do nothing. So I'm thinking like, okay, what can I do? I don't just want to run.
Chris had to be more proactive about clearing his name beyond reporting the vehicle stolen. After all, he had lent it to an old friend, Charles Allen.
So I'm trapped between a rock and a hard place. I'm a rapper. A street rapper at that. I'm talking about gangster stuff at this time, right? I can't call the police and say, such and such did it. My credibility, it'd be done. My career be over with. So I have to do it in a creative way because I got all this good stuff going for me. And then I have the code. And so what I do was call my parole officer immediately. And I got a GPS monitor, right? So it's two parts to the GPS so no one is confused. You have the box where I have to download my data from the GPS, which is important that I left at my house for my parole officer to get. Then you have the actual ankle tracker that's tracking you everywhere you go. That's on my ankle at the time. And so what I do was tell my parole officer, listen, you could find my tracking device downstairs, but I still have the ankle monitor on.
Now, his parole officer was in possession of Chris's alibi evidence, which proved his whereabouts at the time of the crime, while Chris went ahead and made contact with Charles Allen.
I called this guy. Bruh, what did you do with my truck? Bruh, I'm going to tell you about it. Come to the place. I go to his place. Man.
Wait, how did you get past the detectives that were outside the undercovers?
It's different cuts and stuff you could go. His mom stays like probably like a mile away. So I went there. Cut off my ankle monitor there, thinking my ankle thing will be tracked here, right? And maybe this will lead the people to the right guy. He's telling me the story, who's involved. I'll call my brother, call my team. They like, listen, get out of there. Come here. Let's figure this out. And then I went, right? And the whole time I'm in communication with my parole officer. I'm cooperating, getting information. And they saying, well, they retrieved the costume and this and that. And the first thing I said was, run a DNA. You have all this stuff, run a DNA, and please let me know.
Thankfully, they found all three pieces, the wig, the sunglasses, and there was a black t-shirt that the robber was using to pull up over the lower half of his face. Ultimately, those items were tested and came back to exclude Chris and identify this man, Charles Allen. So the one eyewitness described the gunman as a light-skinned black man. And Charles Allen, the man that was ultimately identified, being a light-skinned man, it's always the first thing people describe him as. That's the way he's described in his file with the Hamilton County Police Department. Chris ultimately did say in an interview before the DNA test was conducted that he loaned his truck to Charles Allen. He said what he looks like. He also said light-skinned and short. All of the fingerprints also excluded Chris. And three of them came back to Charles Allen. He was in the APHIS system. So they had Charles Allen from Chris's mouth, from fingerprints.
GPS. Right.
They had a description from a neutral eyewitness of a light-skinned man that matches Charles Allen. They finally did the DNA testing. And boom, it's also Charles Allen. All of this was known before Chris's trial. No one was interested in going after Charles Allen.
I mean, word on the streets is he was helping them with more bigger things, gang stuff, murders, organized crime, and things like that. That's why he was given immunity.
It starts with circumstantial evidence against Chris, and then it turns into literally the easiest case to solve. Literally, Jesus could have popped up and said, that's the guy who did it. And it seems like the judge still would have went, sorry, Jesus. I got a different idea. I mean, and this was a bench trial. Now, we got to talk about that too. But first of all, of course, it's Hamilton County, and we know they have a history of hiding overwhelming evidence of innocence. For instance, Elwood Jones, who we interviewed on this podcast. So Hamilton County, very notorious.
The head prosecutor, of course, was Joe Dieters, the district attorney at the time. But the actual line prosecutor doing the case, it was a guy named Clay Tharp. It wasn't the usual suspects of Seth Teager, Pete Meyer.
Chris, how did you end up with Michelle, an attorney who actually could defend you, which a lot of people don't even have that?
I had an attorney that people was trying to get me to work with, one that's been practicing law for 30 plus years. I really didn't trust this lawyer. And Michelle was there seeing someone else. She was up on our floor in the bullpen. And I seen her, and then I just seen the energy, and I'm like, okay, she looked like she's fairly new. I needed somebody fresh that was going to actually fight for me, and I'm not taking no plea deal, right? So I approached Michelle, and I just sat down with her, and I was telling her about the situation. She was like, yeah, I love to take this case, and this is probably like one of the best decisions I made, even though I was convicted, because I think no matter what attorney I had, I would have been convicted at this point. Because they was just so deep and put so much of their eggs in one basket that it was no turning back.
What they were going to try to say, to still say that this was Chris, was to say that because Chris and Charles knew each other, that somehow Charles's DNA just briefly rubbed off on the costumes, and somehow Chris just got lucky and wasn't on it. So for that reason, we had specifically requested the lab notes and all the data underlying the DNA testing, but that was never turned over at the time of trial.
In addition to demanding the DNA testing and underlying data, they turned their sights on Charles Allen.
Chris and I worked with a private detective to wire up Chris's brother, Ricky, to go talk to Charles. The strategy we were using is Ricky would feed him some wrong facts and see if Charles would like correct it, since he was there and he knew what he did. So remember I said the eyewitness said he saw the gunman come out carrying a laptop. It actually was the cash register drawer, but the eyewitness thought it was a laptop. So Ricky, when he's wired up, says to Charles, they're saying that Chris was coming out of the store carrying a laptop. And Charles says on the recording, "I wasn't carrying a motherfucking laptop. It was a cash drawer." First person, "I wasn't carrying a motherfucking laptop. It was a cash drawer." So we have this on recording. We have eventually additional recordings to this, but we're like, okay, well, this is rock solid now.
And of course, it ends up as a bench trial with Judge Robert Ruhlman, which I'm curious to know how that decision was made.
So Cincinnati, the criminal justice community here is like, everybody knows everybody. So I was talking to every criminal defense attorney, and universally, the one thing to know about Robert Ruhlman is if he takes you back in chambers and is talking with you about the case, and he says, "This sounds like a bench trial," that is your signal that he's going to acquit your person. But at that time, he had been on the bench for decades. I think people get so inundated in the system, unless they are actively checking themselves, they get a mindset that they can just judge a case and that they just know what the right answer is. And so despite that, I think Robert Ruhlman is a good person, and he used his, "This looks like a bench trial to me." He conned us. And the reason that happened, although this played out after the fact, this was not far from his neighborhood. And the police in that area talked with him frequently about the crime in that area of town. And I think that, like Chris was saying, this would have happened with any attorney, because he was going to convict Chris no matter what.
So a trial began in 2008, and the state presented their theory about Charles and Chris committing the robbery together. Charles as the driver and Chris donning the costume and holding up the Cincinnati Bell Wireless store. The eyewitness testified about what he saw, as well as Chris's girlfriend, saying that she had basically given him the expedition.
So the whole trial is playing out. All the DNA is presented. Sure enough, the state tries to go with this theory that Chris just got lucky that his DNA didn't rub off, and Charles somehow got unlucky that his DNA did rub off when he somehow briefly touched these items. So the state closed their case. We put on our case, and the state ended up calling Charles Allen as a rebuttal witness. And I was hoping this is exactly what would happen, that he would somehow be called on the stand, because I got to present his statements to him. Now, of course, these had already been played in court, and he wasn't there to hear them. Four people had already identified his voice on them. But unsurprisingly, he's like, "That's not my voice." So that day, he was waiting in the jail to be called as a witness in this trial. And I got his recorded calls. The first call he makes, he starts complaining that he's salty that Ricky wired up on him and recorded him talking about the robbery. So when he's on the stand saying, "That's not my voice," I got to then play for him the recording of him saying, "Man, I'm so salty that Ricky wired up on me and recorded me," to make it very obvious that this actually is him. In addition, Chris called him many times and got him to talk about things too. You got him to say that he would meet with me, his attorney, to describe other people who were there. He made other incriminating statements, like they must be paying the witnesses to say that Chris did this because they know that he didn't.
You can't be a worse criminal than this guy, right? Right. And now here you are at trial, you're watching this unfold, and it comes to the moment that the judge is going to make his ruling.
We all knew that I was through. It's very rare to go to trial as a defendant and prove your innocence, not just raising the doubt, right? And it's like the harder Michelle went for me, the more irritated this judge became. And it was just a lot of comments and how he said to Michelle, "Well, you did a great job for a public defender." Or, "Yeah, this is not the fugitive movie." It's like he said so many sly comments and convicted me and given me 28 years for a robbery when no one was hurt. To go to jail, period, is something, but to be given all that time for something you didn't do, it's just a whole nother feeling.
Hi, I'm Martha Stewart, and we're back with a new season of my podcast. This season will be even more revealing and more personal. with more entrepreneurs, more trailblazers, more live events, more Martha, and more questions from you. I'm talking to my cosmetic dermatologist, Dr. Dan Belkin, about the secrets behind my skincare. Walter Isaacson about the geniuses who changed the world. Encore Jane about creating a billion-dollar startup. Dr. Eliza Pressman about the five basic strategies to help parents raise good humans. Florence Fabricant about the authenticity in the world of food writing. Be sure to tune in to season two of the Martha Stewart Podcast. Listen and subscribe to the Martha Stewart Podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the best shows of the year, according to Apple, Amazon, and Time, is back for another round. We have more insightful conversations between myself, Paul Muldoon, and Paul McCartney about his life and career.
It was 20 years ago today.
We had a big bear of a man, he's called Mal Evans, he's on roadie. And I was coming back on the plane, and he said, "Will you pass the salt and pepper?" And I misheard him. I said, "What? Sergeant Pepper?"
This season, we're diving deep into some of McCartney's most beloved songs. Yesterday, Band on the Run, Hey Jude. And McCartney's favourite song in his entire catalogue, Here, There and Everywhere. Listen to Season 2 of McCartney, A Life in Lyrics on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What does optimism look like? I'm on a quest to find the people who inspire us to dream more and do more. I'm Simon Sinek, and I host a podcast called A Bit of Optimism. I talk to all sorts of people, from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to a hairdresser on Instagram who gives out free haircuts to the homeless, from the CEOs of the world's largest companies to the comedy writer who visited the wreckage of the Titanic. I love talking to leaders, artists, authors, and eccentrics about life, leadership, purpose, mental fitness, human skills, high performance, and other curious things. It leaves me feeling wiser, more inspired, and, well, more optimistic. Because after all, this is a bit of optimism. The world is full of magic and wonder, if you know where to look for it. Listen to A Bit of Optimism on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the whole conditioning of it, right? It goes beyond just the wrongful conviction, right? The conditioning of it. From the time you walk into the county jail, how they have you stand, how they process you, taking you to a floor where you sit in here all day, let you out, take you to the bullpen, go to court, send you up to another thing. One call is about that control. And it gets in your mind to tell you, this is your life. This is all you worth. Don't expect nothing more, right? And so you do this for years and years, and you just conditioned to feel like shit, to feel like you nothing, to feel like you don't deserve nothing more from being an adult and having correctional officers have a key to your cell that's 10, 15 years younger than you. And you have to say Miss such and such or CO, and it dehumanizes you. And so you go through that for years and years to where it becomes a part of you, right? Shaping me into who I became or who I am today. So how do you find balance of staying true to who you are, but surviving this, right? Because I knew I was coming home and I just didn't know when. Because I knew I had a fighter with Michelle. I knew I had a great organization such as the OIP with me. I'm one of the fortunate ones that came home with an opportunity to get back into society, to have that humanity back restored in me. And I found myself coming home from work and coming in and confining myself to my bedroom, just that one space when I got two floors, because I'm like unconsciously conditioned to be right here just in the bed, having a refrigerator full of food, but only eating chips and noodles. Like, I really went through this phase for at least 90 days straight. And I woke up one day, I was making some noodles for breakfast, ramen noodles. And I was stirring the noodles and I'm the only one in here. And I was like, oh shit, I'm really eating noodles at 10 o'clock in the morning. Made the noodles and took them back in my room like I had to go there. That's what my incarceration did. I took a lot. I went through a lot. My mom died, which was my best friend, the only one of the main supports I had, and me not being able to go to her funeral and listening to it from a jail phone and things like that. Missing your children grow up and all this. And so you have to deal with it because you don't want to come out of this thing destroyed.
In so many of the stories we hear, as our guests struggle with prison life, they also typically receive denials on their direct appeals, while exonerating information remains hidden. But in Chris's case, Chris already had Michelle, and they knew what they needed to do. And still, it took 12 long years.
After Chris was convicted, one of the things I was hell-bent on doing was getting the data underlying the DNA evidence. And my expert reran all the tests. So she retested the wig, the sunglasses, and the t-shirt. And it showed from her lab notes and the state's lab notes that were withheld during his trial that Charles Allen's DNA was present across the board, 14 out of 15 and 15 out of 15 loci on the wig and the t-shirt. The sunglasses, the state's testing came back inconclusive, but my expert post-trial came back and also identified Charles Allen's. We were able to have a post-conviction hearing and present all of this evidence and get it in the record, also with Judge Ruhlman. And my expert, she explained that contrary to the state's theory, that is not consistent with somebody who just briefly handles something, especially a wig. You think about if you just touch a wig, you're touching like the outside of it. The inner part that touches your head when you're wearing it was heavily present with his DNA, and so was the shirt. And she explained that this is evidence that Charles Allen was wearing these items. And we were before the same judge that convicted Chris. And he said on the record, okay, I understand the evidence. The evidence shows that Chris isn't the one who committed this robbery, but I think he was involved somehow. So I'm going to deny this motion and keep his convictions in place.
Which is insane.
Truly insane, because the state's theory from start to finish, and even to that point, was that Chris was the one who wore the costume and came in with the gun and committed this robbery. And Charles claimed that he was the getaway driver. So the judge denied this motion, but at least we were able to get all of this crucial DNA evidence in addition to our DNA testing of the sunglasses that also identified Charles Allen on the record.
Now with the Brady material on the record, they could present it on direct appeal, for which Chris had to hire a different attorney.
I was sending this attorney all kinds of emails, voicemails. Please meet with me. I have to explain this to you. And will you believe that appellate attorney didn't even raise the error of a Brady violation and didn't even include any of the evidence from the post-conviction hearing? Basically, the errors that she raised were non-errors. So, of course, he lost his appeal.
This was the same attorney that I was working with before I ended up retaining Michelle. That's been practicing law for 30 plus years. Everybody that knows her is just like, how did she miss that? And then not communicating with Michelle.
At that point, if there's anything that you don't raise in one court, you can never raise it in a higher court. It's considered procedurally defaulted. So I was still desperate to fix this. So what I did at that point was I got the Ohio Public Defender's Office involved to file a non-routine motion in the appellate court called a Rule 26B motion, which it's available for situations like this where the appellate attorney is ineffective, to try to reopen the appeal and put forth the error that the appellate attorney didn't raise. Now, again, this is still obvious that we should win this, but the court denied the Rule 26B motion and said that the appellate attorney was not ineffective for raising this because, in their opinion, this DNA evidence that was presented in the post-conviction motion was only cumulative to what was already presented at the trial, and it really didn't shed any new light. So they really missed the entire point of it.
While the appeals unfolded, over a decade of Chris's life ticked away, and they moved on to federal court, where there are ways to raise procedurally defaulted issues. After one denial, they had a win at the next level in the Sixth Circuit.
They issued an amazing decision in June of 2019. And this was the first court that ever understood that the state was repeatedly putting forth false claims, like the judge did. Chris was involved somehow. I have a hunch he was involved in this somehow. And that's not a valid basis for conviction. And in fact, all the evidence showed the exact opposite. The Sixth Circuit had to remand it back to the district court to actually decide the merits of the Brady claim and the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim. And they ended up not having to rule on the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim because the Brady violation trumped it. So finally, in April of 2020, height of the COVID pandemic, Chris was finally released.
Chris was supposed to be released on April 9th, 2020. And with a comorbidity, his release during the early days of the COVID pandemic could not have been more urgent.
April 9th come, and Michelle, we have steady communication. She's like, it's going to happen. Like, yeah, you're being released. And so I'm just like ready, seal packed, can't sleep the night before. My son, who's at this time is what, 19 years old, haven't seen him since 7. He comes up to Toledo with Michelle, and all day, just waiting, not getting answers, anything. And then finally, 11:30 that evening, they come into my cell and saying, okay, you're being released. And just to have that sense of freedom, right? And you getting dressed out and things like that. And then walk out and Highway Patrol is sitting there waiting, not your family, but Highway Patrol is sitting there waiting with chains and saying, hey, you coming with us? So I'm like, hold up, wait a minute. Where's my lawyer? Like, are you coming with us? Don't worry about it. And chaining me, not in the back, but in the front of a Highway Patrol car. A Highway Patrolman get in the back behind me. And it's like, at this point, 12:31 in the morning, and we driving from Toledo to Cincinnati, which is a 3.5-hour drive. And you just got this patrolman sitting behind you and you up front with your hands visible. And I'm just sitting up. Came over the scariest thing in my life. Because in my mind, I'm like, oh my God, I'm just waiting to hear, drop the weapon, or he reached for my gun. And they kill me right there. I mean, I'm having to like scratch my nose. I don't want to move. I'm just right here, just sitting straight up, just watching the road, not asking questions or anything, just take me where I'm going. And they end up processing me in the county jail.
Hi, I'm Martha Stewart, and we're back with a new season of my podcast. This season will be even more revealing and more personal, with more entrepreneurs, more trailblazers, more live events, more Martha, and more questions from you. I'm talking to my cosmetic dermatologist, Dr. Dan Belkin, about the secrets behind my skincare. Walter Isaacson about the geniuses who changed the world. Encore Jane about creating a billion-dollar startup. Dr. Eliza Pressman about the 5 basic strategies to help parents raise good humans. Florence Fabricant about the authenticity in the world of food writing. Be sure to tune in to Season 2 of the Martha Stewart Podcast. Listen and subscribe to the Martha Stewart Podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the best shows of the year, according to Apple, Amazon, and Time, is back for another round. We have more insightful conversations between myself, Paul Muldoon, and Paul McCartney about his life and career.
It was 20 years ago today.
We had a big bear of a man. He's called Mal Evans. He's on roadie. And I was coming back on the plane, and he said, will you pass the salt and pepper? And I misheard him. I said, what? Sergeant Pepper?
This season, we're diving deep into some of McCartney's most beloved songs. Yesterday, Band on the Run, Hey Jude. And McCartney's favourite song in his entire catalogue, Here, There and Everywhere. Listen to Season 2 of McCartney, A Life in Lyrics on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What does optimism look like? I'm on a quest to find the people who inspire us to dream more and do more. I'm Simon Sinek, and I host a podcast called A Bit of Optimism. I talk to all sorts of people, from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to a hairdresser on Instagram who gives out free haircuts to the homeless, from the CEOs of the world's largest companies to the comedy writer who visited the wreckage of the Titanic. I love talking to leaders, artists, authors, and eccentrics about life, leadership, purpose, mental fitness, human skills, high performance, and other curious things. It leaves me feeling wiser, more inspired, and, well, more optimistic. Because after all, this is a bit of optimism. The world is full of magic and wonder, if you know where to look for it. Listen to A Bit of Optimism on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The writ hit said that Chris was to be immediately released under no conditions. So they weren't following the orders. So I got a ruling from the federal judge saying that he essentially was going to hold the state in contempt if you weren't released. And what we found out a couple days later, ironically, Judge Ruhlman came to our aid, is that on April 9th, when the federal court issued the writ ordering Chris released, Hamilton County called Judge Ruhlman and said, there's this order on this case that was your case saying that Chris Smith is to be released, but we want to continue to hold him to bring him to trial again. Can we get an order to do that? Which they were not allowed to do. That's in direct violation of the federal order. And Judge Ruhlman said to them, I need to see the federal order first before I can do that. They didn't give it to him. So he thought the issue was just dropped. But no, that is not what happened. Because this was COVID, not all the judges were present. They were having like alternate judges coming in. The prosecutors went to the judge who was the presiding judge who was physically there at the courtroom and told her that Judge Ruhlman said for her to sign this order on his case to have Chris Smith brought back, which he explicitly did not do. But she signed it because that's what she was told Ruhlman wanted. And Chris was brought back to Hamilton County in defiance of the federal order. And a few days later, we finally got in court in front of Judge Ruhlman. Judge Ruhlman was then 100% on our side and saying, no, Chris Smith has to be released. Very, very angry with the county prosecutors at what they had done, deceiving him.
The Hamilton County Court of Common Pleas issued a release order as well, but the state continued on, appealing whether the federal court even had the jurisdiction to rule on the Brady material. Nevertheless, Chris was freed on April 14th, 2020.
I just came home and hit the ground running. Just got back to things I was doing before I went in, such as my music, just building a brand, a lot of things that I started even before I was released, as far as like starting my own company and got into promotion and things like that. Got married and I got a job, a good opportunity at a dealership here. Started excelling in that, working with Found Village, organization of at-risk youth. Coaching football, mentoring youth, just doing everything I could to contribute to the goodness of this world. And just to stay busy, I just didn't really want to think about where I came from and kind of just put it behind me and just press forward.
State appealed Chris's habeas petition on the basis of saying that the state appellate court, when they denied that Rule 26B motion, if you'll remember back, that was the one to get his direct appeal reopened to raise the Brady claims. When appealing his habeas grant, the state said that 26B motion ruled on the Brady claim. They said something like, the appellate attorney didn't mess up here because any claim of a Brady violation wasn't material.
Even though the Brady violation in question was most definitely material, the DNA testing's underlying data thwarted the state's theory and proved Chris's innocence.
The state was now saying the federal district court was wrong to grant the habeas petition because the state court already ruled on your Brady claim and they didn't get it wrong. And the federal court can't undo a state court ruling unless it's contrary to or an unreasonable application of U.S. Supreme Court precedent. And so when we went before the Sixth Circuit the second time with a horrendous panel, they agreed with the state and said, yes, in fact, despite everything that our same court said about the DNA evidence shows that you weren't the gunman, the trial evidence shows that you weren't an accomplice. The state appellate court's ruling when they rejected your 26B motion has to stand because some reasonable minds could think that way. So the Sixth Circuit reversed the grant of the habeas petition.
Once that decision came back, I lost that drive and I stopped writing. I stopped creating. I stopped moving the company forward and just became content with working. That's how you condition, like when you're in prison, like going to a chow hall or having your porter job and then going back to your cell.
So where his case technically stands now, there's kind of two parts to it. Sixth Circuit remanded it back to the district court again to rule on the merits of the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim. We had to brief that in May of 2021, and it's still been pending since then. And Chris was, of course, under threat of having to go back to prison because his habeas grant was reversed. And so Judge Ruhlman recused himself, passed the case off to a different judge, a newly elected, absolutely fantastic judge, Jennifer Branch, on his case in state court now, who granted Chris judicial release, basically commuted the remainder of his sentence so that he could not go back to prison on this, but left it so that he's on supervision by the state court, so to speak, so that we still retain jurisdiction in federal court to get his convictions officially wiped off the record once and for all.
You know, I have a probation officer, a parole officer, so technically I'm not free. And when I'm here and enjoying my day and I get a knock on the door and look out the people, it's two probation officers with guns and badges and vests on, like I'm a threat, one standing on the side of the door and I let them in and it could just pop up and invade my home at any given time. There's no freedom in that. I don't feel free. And in that process, you're damaging and undermining and uprooting everything that I've worked so hard for since I've been home. And just recently, I claimed that freedom back on my 42nd birthday, November 3rd. I woke up and I said, you know what? This chapter 42 is going to represent freedom, true freedom within self. And I'm getting back to me, putting it to me, and I'm not about to let no prison or me even being exonerated define my sense of freedom.
Well, I wish you all the best on your journey, all the best of everything. And I hope this means you'll be making more music too. Is that fair to assume?
Yeah, I'm on major platforms. I'm everywhere. I'm back creating. Michelle is actually on the first song that I recorded when I came home. It's Remember Me. We have a video of that on YouTube. Reality with Old Hal.
I have to just brag on Chris for just a minute. He's a brilliant writer. And that video that he was just talking about, he was released in mid-April 2020. He recorded this about a month later. I mean, just to think about that whirlwind he was going through. And then you see what he was able to put together in just a few weeks. If you watch that video, Remember Me, it's mind-boggling. I mean, it's just the tip of the iceberg of his talent.
Well, we're going to be sure to have your music, your YouTube channel, and Instagram linked in the episode description for everyone to follow. And with that, we're going to go to closing arguments. First of all, thank you for being here and sharing this remarkable story. And then I'm going to switch my microphone off, kick back in my chair with my headphones on and close my eyes and just listen to anything else you want to share with me and our incredible audience. So, Michelle, why don't you go first and then just hand the mic off to Chris and he'll take us off into the sunset.
I think an important takeaway is that people get involved in elections to an extent thinking about, oh, what president am I going to elect? What congressman? But it's really important to look at what judges are on the ballot. And it might be a little more difficult to know which judge is the right judge to elect. So go seek out information from your local Innocence Project or your local public defender's office and seek advice about who will be a fair judge on that ballot. Because I think something that's overlooked is the power of judges here in our country at the state court level. Our judges are elected. They are politicians like anyone else at that point, and they will decide cases based on their ideology, and that can lead to wrongful convictions, and it did here. And so it's very important to educate yourself on who to elect and pay attention to those elections too, not just the president and the congressman. I think Chris's case is a case in point for that. And Chris's case points out also tunnel vision and what that can do. This often happens in court cases and in wrongful conviction cases, but this can happen in everyday life too. You hear just in your everyday encounters, you hear some gossip of something crazy. You hear bits and pieces and you form a conclusion. And then when you hear a few days later the full story or the other person's side to it, what actually happened is completely different. Or you hear a news headline of a world event and it seems unbelievable or maybe very believable to you, and you start leaping to conclusions based on that. And then time plays out and there's more to the story. So I think it's just very important in life. These wrongful convictions teach us this. Don't jump to conclusions. Don't jump down those tunnels and have your decisions made up so early that you can't have an open mind to hearing things out, hearing what the bigger picture might be. I think overall, like, people would have more peaceful lives. The world would be a more peaceful place. Certainly there would be less wrongful convictions. I mean, it's just an important concept to learn that Chris's case teaches about. Hear all sides, look at objective facts, educate yourself, and then form your conclusions.
I just want to say in closing, it's not about guilt. It's not about innocence. It's about us just playing our part to just contribute to the goodness of the world. Everybody makes mistakes, whether it's the defendant or the prosecution, the judges, the appellate court. Everybody makes mistakes, but it's about what we do afterwards. It's like, you could think about that storm I went through, but we're still talking about that storm right now because we made it out that storm, right? It's about what we do now. It's about what we learned while we was in the midst of that storm. We hear this so often. It's so common, right? Would it stop next year, 5 years from now, 10 years from now? Probably not. But we just got to do our part, because each one of us can make a difference. All we need is that one opportunity.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
The Black Information Network and 6-time Emmy-nominated news anchor Vanessa Tyler welcome you to Blackland,
a podcast about the ground on which the Black community stands right now.
From stories about salvation
and loss.
I loved a person who had an HIV diagnosis.
To dreams achieved
or yet unfulfilled.
From people who have made it.
I sat down with a therapist and I began my journey.
To those left behind.
Listen to Blackland on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts,
or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, fellow 20-somethings. It's your girl, Sydney Winter. And guess what? The wait is finally over. Season 4 of Crying in Public is here, and I'm flying solo for the very first time. That's right, no co-host to rein me in, just me, myself, and the mic. From relationships to careers and all the awkward encounters in between, we're covering it all. So mark your calendars and set your reminders, because Crying in Public is dropping its juiciest season yet. Listen to the new season of Crying in Public on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Nazi V2 was a rocket-powered bomb traveling faster than the speed of sound. You couldn't hear it coming. A technological miracle, but a military and economic disaster for Nazi Germany. How did the V2 come into existence? And why were so many of the people it hurt not the people you might expect? Join me, Tim Harford, host of Cautionary Tales, for my gripping mini-series on the V2 rocket, available now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.